Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. In this episode, I'm going to preview a case called Rosales-Morales v. United States, which is going to be argued on Wednesday, February 21st, 2018. Now, Rosales-Morales v. United States is a case about the federal sentencing guidelines. And first, let me give you a little background to begin about the sentencing guidelines. So the federal sentencing guidelines are non-binding guidelines. They're created by something called the United States Sentencing Commission. And the guidelines are based on particular characteristics of a particular crime and also the criminal history of the particular defendant. And what happens is, under federal law, a lot of crimes have the statutory range of punishment for the crime is often extremely broad. There are crimes, for example, that are punishable by 0 to 20 years in prison. It's a huge range. And it may cover a crime where there are huge variations in the seriousness or severity of the particular crime. And so the sentencing guidelines will provide that based on certain characteristics of the specific incident being charged. So things whether there was certain levels of violence involved in the crime, or for drug crimes, for example, the amount, the quantity of drugs being distributed, or the number of victims that are impacted, or the amount of damage or amount of loss to victims of a crime, things like that. Based on all these various factors, the guidelines will give the guidelines they involve a chart which provides a level for the offense, an offense level, and also criminal history level for the particular defendant, just based on their prior convictions. And by looking at the chart and looking at the criminal history level of the defendant and the score that's been generated for the particular crime, you result in a range of months on the sentencing chart. Is deemed to be the sentencing commission's determination of the appropriate range of punishment for that particular crime, and it's given in a range of months. So it may provide, for example, for a particular crime, maybe it's 48 to 60 months or something like that, which would come out to 4 to 5 years. But there's these various ranges of months for different crimes depending on these particular circumstances. Now, I mentioned before it's non-binding. This is a result of some Supreme Court cases a little more than a decade ago. It had previously been binding and mandatory, but for reasons we won't get into here, it's now considered non-binding and just advisory. But what happens is, after a defendant is convicted or pleads guilty, the probation office prepares a pre-sentence investigation report, sometimes called a PSR, which creates various information about the defendant and about the crime. And in that, the probation office prepares a calculation of the proper sentencing range for this convicted defendant. Now, the judge, the trial judge who's doing the sentencing, is required to calculate the sentence, which they usually rely on this the pre-sentence investigation report to arrive at that calculation, and they're required to consider that sentence, the guideline sentence, but the judge is not required to follow it. The judge can, when the judge goes outside of that range, either above or below the range that the guidelines would point to, that's referred to as a departure. And there's downward departures where the judge is more lenient than the guidelines would suggest. Sometimes that's on the motion of the government, when the government has said that the defendant perhaps has cooperated with the government in particular ways, or has, or just has particular characteristics that ask for that. Suggest that there should be more lenience. But the judge could also depart upward and give a harsher sentence than the guidelines would suggest. Now, upward departures are fairly unusual. They happen in only a very small percentage of the cases. Downward departures are much more common. But the guidelines ranges are considered to be hugely influential to the court. Many sentences, many judges routinely sentence within the guidelines range. They may, if the guidelines provide a range of months, if it's a, seems to be a particularly, bad, particularly culpable, defendant, then they'll lean toward the high end of the range, or if they seem more sympathetic, they'll go toward the lower end of the range, but they often stay within the range. But even when they depart, the judges will often use that range as kind of a starting point. They'll say the guidelines say that you should be sentenced in this particular range, but because of these factors, I'm going to go down from there some degree. So even though they're non-binding, they're hugely influential and have a huge effect on the ultimate sentence that gets imposed. So with that background, let's turn to the facts of this particular case. The defendant in this case is named Florencio Rosales Morales, and he's a Mexican national who pleaded guilty to illegally reentering the United States after being previously removed from the country. Now, he also had a number of previous arrests and convictions. He was convicted for aggravated assault in which he stabbed a man multiple times, and that's the crime that had resulted in his previous deportation. He also had multiple convictions and other arrests for beating and choking his wife, including an incident in which he grabbed his wife by her hair and repeatedly punched her in the face. So he had some serious previous criminal history. Now, as a result of this criminal history and his guilty plea on the illegal reentry crime, the guidelines range for his conviction was calculated to be 77 to 96 months. That comes out, if you do the math, roughly 6.5 to 8 years, approximately. Now, he argued through his lawyer, he argued at the sentencing for a downward departure. The judge rejected that and sentenced him in the end for 78 months. So that's 6.5 years, which is near the low end of the range. The range was 77 to 96. He got 78 months. So he's just a month above the lower end of the suggested, the recommended guidelines sentencing range. Now, it turns out that his criminal history was actually calculated incorrectly. The probation officer who calculated it accidentally double counted one of his misdemeanor assault convictions. And that pushed him into a different criminal history category, and which resulted in a incorrect guidelines range. So the range he was sentenced under was 77 to 96 months. He actually, his correct range would have been 70 to 87 months. So it's slightly lower. The low end goes from 77 down to 70. The high end goes from 96 down to 87. So it's a somewhat lower by, you know, a little more than half a year lower average range. Now, an important thing to note is that his actual sentence he received from the judge, the 78-month sentence, which was near the bottom of the incorrect range, is still well within the correct range and is actually still in the bottom half of the correct range. So he didn't end up with a sentence that was wildly out of step with the correct range, but it was the range, you know, that presumably guided the judge in choosing that number was incorrect. So how does this get to the Supreme Court? So the issue here is that obviously his lawyer did not catch this mistake. No one caught this mistake. Neither the prosecutor nor his lawyer nor the court itself had caught this. If this had been caught, it would have been immediately corrected during the sentencing hearing. These kind of corrections to guidelines calculations are routine. It's part of the attorney's job to review the calculations and make sure there's nothing wrong. And it's just a normal part of sentencing hearings for attorneys to raise if there's certain if they think there are errors, or sometimes there's contested issues that are in the pre-sentence investigation report. And judges are used to this and making adjustments when necessary to the guidelines range based on errors that are pointed out. And presumably if this had happened during the sentencing hearing, then the judge would have corrected the range, corrected the criminal history calculation, found the correct range, and then used that range as a starting point for the calculation for the sentence determination. But here, the attorney missed this. There was no objection made at the sentencing. And so the question here is, can Rosales-Morales come back now on appeal and argue that he should be resentenced on the basis of this mistake? Now, in trials, in both criminal and civil trials, a great many potential errors that can be made at trial are waived if the attorney doesn't preserve them. And by preserving them, it means pointing out the error and objecting or making the court aware that some error has occurred or allegedly occurred. There's, you know, several reasons for this, but an important reason is by raising errors immediately when they occur. It gives the judge who's there in the trial court, it gives the judge the opportunity to try and immediately correct whatever error was made. And that just lets things move forward and, you know, avoids having to come back on appeal and try and fix things later and unwind things that should have been corrected at the time. And so many errors that are not objected to or otherwise brought to the court's attention at the trial level are considered unpreserved and they're lost. You can't bring them back up on appeal. There are exceptions, however, and so there's a rule. This is the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, which are just a set of rules that guide the way courts trials, criminal procedures play out, and dictate, for example, just when certain things happen, when certain motions need to be made, or the order and timing of various aspects of a criminal proceedings. One of the rules, Rule 52B, it says, a plain error that affects substantial rights may be considered even though it was not brought to the court's attention. All right. So that's the provision that's at issue here. So criminal procedure, Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52B. Now, there are previous Supreme Court precedents interpreting this rule and saying when is it appropriate for these plain errors to be corrected by the court? Because the rule just says these plain errors may be considered. It doesn't say they shall be considered or must be considered. It just says they may be considered. So when is a court properly exercising its role to correct these errors? The Supreme Court has set a four-part test, and this is the way it goes. First, there must be an error. Second, the error must be clear or obvious rather than subject to reasonable dispute. Now, nobody disputes that those two parts of the test apply here. Everyone accepts, the government accepts that there was a miscalculation here. That was a mistake. That's not in question. Now, the third prong says the error affected the appellant's substantial rights, which in the ordinary case means it affected the outcome of the district court proceedings. Now, there are also precedents, Supreme Court precedents, that say that an error in calculating the guidelines qualifies as this type of error. So that brings us to the fourth prong, and this is where all the argument is here in this case. The fourth prong is the error seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. And that's where all the argument is going here. Rosales-Morales says on appeal that this error in calculating the sentencing guideline requires resentencing because it seriously affects the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the proceedings. While the government has conceded the error in the calculation, the government opposes the resentencing. Now, the government won below, and the Court of Appeals below said that the sentence remains a reasonable sentence, first of all, and the Court of Appeals applied a standard where they said that under this test, a correction of a plain error is really only appropriate where it's a really serious error that basically shocks the conscience, that it's something so severe and so bad that the court just has to step in and correct it. Now, let's kind of get into some of the arguments that the two sides are making. So the defendant, Rosales-Morales, says that a mistake in the guidelines calculation does seriously affect the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of the proceedings. Because of the role the guidelines play, a flawed calculation leading to a judge basing the sentence off the wrong range is just blatantly unfair. As a result of this, any guidelines calculation error just presumptively satisfies the standard. If the judge is basing a sentence on just a faulty calculation, then that just can't meet the standards of fairness that are that should be expected from a court. And Rosales-Morales also argues that resentencing is the right approach because it serves certain purposes behind the sentencing guidelines. It retains the trial court's discretion. So when this goes back to the trial judge for resentencing, the judge would not have to resentence him to a lower sentence. The judge could, if the judge decides, say that based on all the characteristics of the crime and the considerations that were taken in crafting the 78-month sentence, that that's still the appropriate sentence and should remain the appropriate sentence. However, in practice, most judges in this circumstance, these cases come up fairly regularly where there's some sort of adjustment. Sometimes it's a retroactive thing where the Sentencing Commission has lowered the sentencing range at some point in time from it was previously a higher range, and they come back and lower it, and there are provisions where a defendant can go back and have the judge resentence them under the lower range. And usually when things like this come back to a judge, most judges adjust the sentence down after the correction in the range. But the judge would retain the discretion that the judge had to craft the appropriate sentence for the particular defendant given this particular circumstances of the crime. And Rosales-Morales also argues that this allowing the correction, it serves the purposes that the sentencing guidelines were intended for in the first place, which is to promote uniformity across the federal courts so that people with similar crimes and similar histories would result in similar sentences. And he also argues that there are other impacts beyond just the sentence itself. For example, the criminal history, which was what was incorrect in this calculation, the criminal history is used for prison classification purposes. So that's just another negative impact that flows out of this beyond just the number of months of the sentence. And he also argues that this is a simple, kind of low-cost job for the courts. It's just a matter of fixing a mistaken mathematical calculation, having the judge impose a new sentence. And especially when you weigh it against the cost of a longer sentence, if, for example, he got 6 months chopped off his sentence, the cost of incarcerating someone for 6 months is substantial, and it's more than the cost of just going through the this kind of a resentencing. So that's kind of the arguments on the one side. Now the United States comes back and says that under the test imposed by the Supreme Court on issues of plain error, on correcting unpreserved errors, that it's clear that this is supposed to be the exceptional case, not routine. The court may correct these errors, but it's supposed to be a fairly high standard. Now, the United States does not endorse the Court of Appeals as shocking to the conscience standard, but does say that it should be relatively high. And part of the reasons are that there needs to be a strong incentive to have all errors raised in a timely manner before the trial court where they can potentially be corrected and where the full context is present for the judge to address and issue any problems that have occurred. Both for accuracy purposes, for efficiency purposes, and not having these cases repeatedly returning to trial court, and to avoid in some cases kind of sandbagging where an attorney might avoid mentioning some particular error that they believe has occurred. If it's a minor error, avoid bringing it up, hoping to get a positive result, but kind of keeping it in the back pocket to try and get a second bite at the apple if they end up with a harsh sentence and just give them another opportunity for resentencing. And the United States argues that the standard that Rosales-Morales argues for, that basically any error in calculating the sentencing guideline is enough to seriously implicate the fairness, integrity, or public reputation. That effectively eliminates the importance of the fourth prong because the third prong of the court's test, that the error affected a substantial right or affected the outcome of the district court proceedings, under the Rosales-Morales' argument, the United States says, that third prong would basically dictate that the court had to necessarily correct errors, and it makes that fourth prong meaningless. And that was not the Supreme Court's intent in imposing this other standard. The United States instead says that there's a number of factors that should be considered by a court in determining whether to exercise the discretion. One of those factors is the new sentence still a reasonable sentence? Here they say, well, yes, it is, because it's still within the new range, even if it's not at the very bottom of the range like it was before. They say, look at the relative size of the error. So the number of months that would be potentially chopped off the sentence compared to the overall total sentence. And also they ask whether the defendant received the appropriate procedural protections below. So the defendant and the defendant's attorney had the opportunity to review the pre-sentence investigation report. They had the opportunity to argue for mitigating circumstances before the trial court, to argue for a shorter sentence. So those procedural protections are there. So the government says, in light of these various factors, in this particular case, the court should not intervene to try and correct this error below. And the other arguments that the petitioner made, for example, about the uniformity of the federal sentencing guidelines, the uniformity that's aimed at by that, and the fact that this has an effect on a liberty interest, which is a very important constitutional interest. Those types of arguments would apply to pretty much any error in a criminal process, which could affect someone's liberty interest and might result in disuniformity between similar cases in different places. So they just prove too much. They would require the court to correct any and all errors, which was not the intent of the court's standard. And then they push back on the burden argument that this is a simple, low-cost process. And they say that, you know, on one hand, it wastes the district court's resources to have to squeeze these resentencings into its docket, but also that in some cases it may be a significant undertaking. The defendant has a right to prevent mitigation in evidence. There may be a requirement of hearing witnesses on certain issues. This could be a significant drain on trial court resources that shouldn't be taken lightly. So those are the basic questions on both sides, and so it'll be interesting to see to what degree the court's decision here, the Supreme Court's decision, is highly specific to this sentencing context, or whether they say something that kind of applies more broadly to plain error review. Again, this case will be argued on February 21st, and we expect an opinion by the end of June. And that's it for this episode. Please subscribe to Counting to Five on YouTube or your audio podcast app of choice. For timely coverage of the latest developments of the court, please check out Counting to Five's weekly YouTube live streams, where you can ask your own questions in the live chat. And those live streams are currently broadcasting Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern time, but you can always check the Counting to Five YouTube channel for the next scheduled live stream. And I'm always looking for feedback. Please leave a comment or send me an email at mike@countingtofive.com. And thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.